thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's November 2021, and this is episode 261, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the film Dune, directed by Denis Villeneuve. On this episode, I'm joined by Cole Burgett, who is a recent seminary graduate. He's also a graduate of the Moody Bible Institute and an author for the website Christ in Pop Culture. Cole has written an online exclusive film review of Dune, and it's called Dune and the Future of the Science Fiction Epic. All of our subscribers can read it for free at our website, equip.org. And if you're not a subscriber would like to read this review, please go to our website, equip.org, to subscribe to our journal. Cole, it's good to have you on.
Always good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Dune goes all the way back to the original source material, which is a book that was written in 1965. And so it's been a long time. And of course, it's had various different, maybe infamous adaptations, one by David Lynch in the 1980s. And so there was also a sci-fi miniseries based on this too. But this book is rather sprawling. And so it's been notoriously hard to adapt is what it's been known for. And of course, it's been one of the best-selling sci-fi book series of all time, the original three books. And so this was really highly anticipated. It was supposed to be out sooner, but of course, the pandemic pushed it into 2021. But this is probably being introduced to a whole new generation since it was published so many years ago in 1965. And what makes this an important sci-fi property? And then, of course, I guess the big question that I want to talk to you a little bit about is, why should Christians watch this film or care about this particular series and universe? And especially I'm asking you this because after our last conversation a few weeks ago about James Bond, someone commented on YouTube that, hey, I get that you do this. I guess you're trying to, you know, get some new subscribers from this, but I don't really care. Who cares about James Bond? Who cares about all these TV and film series? So that's a Christian wondering about why we should care.
Sure. So to get into the topic of Dune, let's start with just an overview like you've started to give. Dune is one of the most prestigious properties in science fiction. The original novel was written in 1965, as you mentioned, by Frank Herbert. And though it wasn't really an overnight sensation, it was a big hit with critics. And over time, it became one of the best-selling science fiction novels ever written. So in terms of genre studies, it's very hard to discuss science fiction without interfacing with Dune at all. It was hugely influential on numerous series that came after it. Spice, for example, the mineral that is mined on Arrakis is sort of copied into Star Wars, you know, the spice mines of Kessel. Later movies like Pitch Black and the Riddick series take some inspiration from the planet. So it's a very influential property, at least in terms of science fiction. As far as Christians interfacing with this, I mean, the significance of the property sort of speaks for itself. Any Christian who is interested in science fiction, you know, if you take a class on science fiction or the history of it, whether you're in seminary, I took one in seminary, or if you're doing it in a secular school, you're going to at least become familiar with Dune. It's just going to happen. It's unavoidable. In terms of footprint, it's arguably as big as, if not bigger than, somebody like Isaac Asimov or Heinlein, who's a personal favorite. And as we'll get into shortly, Dune is a novel expressly concerned with themes about saviors and hero worship. So Dune itself wants to interface and interact with ideas that religions are built on. And as far as I'm concerned, interacting with Herbert's ideas is exactly what he wanted people to do. So that I think is gives you a good sense of why Dune is as important as it is, and why Christians should interface with it.
Now, one thing that's true about this particular property is that it has been a subject of controversy. Could you tell us a little bit about that controversy, and what about this novel makes it subversive, I also know, looking into it, is that originally it was supposed to be kind of this, you know, magnum opus, you know, more than 1,000 pages, and yet it's a trilogy. And so I don't know if that was, oh, well, you know, Lord of the Rings was a trilogy, if his publisher thought kind of along those lines, and why they didn't keep it as one entirely really in-depth novel.
When Herbert sat down to write the story, so the legend goes, it was sort of envisioned as one massive novel that was eventually broken up into parts, which is probably for the best. It really is a lengthy, lengthy work. But as far as the controversy that has surrounded the book, books, I guess, plural, as mentioned, Dune directly wants to interact with the idea of messianic figures and what they mean to people, why people congregate around them, worship them, and whether or not they are actually good for society. And Herbert's perspective on this is more along the lines of, there's no such thing as an infallible hero, and any hero is ultimately going to have some sort of downfall. Even if you did have some kind of infallible messianic figure, the people who are going to come along and take up their cause in the aftermath are ultimately fallible in and of themselves and are basically going to, you know, screw it all up. Now, to get an idea for just how subversive this is and original this is in the context of science fiction and what's popular today, imagine Star Wars, the original trilogy, which came out 12 years after Herbert's novel. When George Lucas sat down to write Star Wars, he was a student of mythology and Joseph Campbell. Mythology, which, as we've talked about in other podcasts, builds itself on mythic ideas and mythic themes, such as these messianic figures. I mean, you know, C.S. Lewis called the Christian story the true myth. It's the myth that actually happens in history. But the story of the Bible uses these mythic literary tropes, and it tells a mythic story. And it's built around a messianic figure. So Star Wars, especially the prequels that Lucas did, have this, you know, chosen one prophecy, this mythic hero who's going to, you know, bring balance to the Force. And even in the original trilogy, Luke's original hero's journey to becoming a Jedi, it builds him into this great hero. When you go to Dune, Paul Atreides, the protagonist, he basically follows the same hero's journey as Luke. But whereas Luke's story is one of continually overcoming fear, atoning for failure, growing beyond mistakes, you know, he's even doing this in the sequel trilogy, Paul's journey is very much not that. He starts the journey, but along the way, that journey is going to take some hard turns, and where his story ends isn't necessarily heroic at all. Now, that's the thematic approach, a kind of critique of religions and messiahs and the followers of messiahs in general. But on a more superficial level, why is it so controversial and subversive? Oh, it's just not your usual science fiction. You know, this is not the sweeping space opera of Star Wars. It's not, you know, these tons of planets that you're hopping between. There's no lasers. There's no lightsabers. There's not a lot of hard science like Star Trek either. It's very mythic, and there's a lot of, you know, hard fantastical science, like the details of the suits they have to wear to survive the desert. But it's just very imaginative. It's very different. And it's designed to be provocative with the ideas it's playing with. And so that sort of is a lot of the controversy that goes on surrounding Dune. Some people, because of the way Herbert chooses to tell his story, some, you know, diehard science fiction fans don't even consider the book science fiction. It's much more along the lines of what somebody might call a fantasy or something like that. So it's just interesting. It's long been a property that has flirted with controversy.
Well, one thing that's noted about the new film or any adaptation of Dune is the book itself, or the trilogy, if we want to call it the first three books, is notoriously hard to condense down into a film. Of course, the most infamously known one, the one that David Lynch did back in the 1980s, did try to tell the entire story in his film. But when you come to this new version directed by Denis Villeneuve, it says on there part one. So you know you're not going to get the whole story going into this very lengthy film. It's more than 2.5 hours long. So I have two questions for you. One is, how do you think that this particular new film honors Herbert's original vision? And secondly, what, you know, there might be a lot of Dune noobs out there. I was, when I went to see this film, I'd never read the books. I knew that the property existed. I did not know anything about the story. In fact, the only thing I knew about the story was that there were worms in it and that it was on a desert. That's all I knew. And so, you know, I just went in totally cold turkey to the film, wondering if I was going to even figure out what was going on. And I did think that the director was able to tell, in my opinion, a coherent story for someone who was a total noob to this. But there might be people listening who are in the same position as myself and trying to decide, should they go see it? So can you give us a little bit of overview and of what the story even is for the uninitiated?
Dune is a pretty interesting tale. It follows a young man named Paul Atreides, who stands in the line of this family in a future where everything is a little bit feudal. It's a very interesting vision of the future where solar systems are operating on a feudal system. So there are fiefdoms, and it's kind of archaic and medieval in that sense. And Paul Atreides stands in this family's line. And his family is sort of given by the emperor rights to this planet called Arrakis. And on this planet, they mine this commodity called spice, which is sort of needed for interstellar travel. It's a really, really important commodity. And it's a very harsh planet ruled by a separate, very harsh family. And the Atreides inherit this, and they basically go to this planet and begin to get involved in the politics and take over what's going on there. But as these types of, you know, political dramas are wont to do, things are not as clear as it seems. There's a lot of cloak and dagger political games that go on behind the scenes where the family is sort of being set up to fail. What's interesting about Paul, though, and it has to do with his mother's lineage, and this order that she's attached to. There are these what you might call prophecies surrounding his being, his growing up, his birth, that sort of begin to cast him as this messianic figure. And the natives to this planet that mine the spice sort of look at him in that way. They're sort of trying to figure out if Paul could be this messianic figure. And that is really, I tried not to give too many spoilers there, but that really sets up the story that Dune is going to carry forward. What's interesting is that really is like the movie. That's what it sets up, and then it kind of ends as soon as it sets it up. But this is to talk about how the film sort of honors Herbert's vision. This is very much Villeneuve's movie. I commented to a friend after seeing it something like, this is his Dune, not Herbert's Dune, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Everybody's a critic until they try to write a screenplay. I tell people all the time, your opinion is your own, but before you criticize, try and write a screenplay. It's remarkably difficult. And to adapt a property like Dune, oh my gosh, it's so hard. You have to make choices. What stays in? What can go? What angle do you find to introduce the audience to the story? What is the primary narrative that you're going to follow over a limited time frame of roughly 2 hours? There's just so much that goes into it. And there's so much more to the story. There's so much more interesting nuance to what Herbert does in his novel. He pulls from very, you know, Eastern cultures. There's Islamic influences in there, very Eastern influences as well. And if you're watching the film, you'll see it in the architecture. You'll see it in the dress, the way these people are clothed. That's all taken from Herbert's novel. Again, it's all intentionally not what you're used to seeing. It's a Western framework for telling the story, Western mythic framework, but it starts to pull from Eastern ideas, and that tends to throw people. Again, it flirts with controversy. But what the film does is it looks at all of this and it finds a way to establish Paul Atreides and send him out on the first steps of his journey. The film is basically an adaptation of the first half of Herbert's novel. So it's not at all, it does not leave you with a sense of completion, really, at all. It sort of ends just as things are kind of getting good, if you know what I mean. You're sort of left wondering. But the decisions were made by the writers and ultimately the director to focus on Paul's journey and to service the story around that. And it was clearly never intended to be the end. The title card at the beginning called it Part One. So clearly they envision sequels and future stories. And that's it's all intentional. Dune is one of those properties, as you mentioned, that many have tried to adapt and failed miserably at doing it. It's long been considered unfilmable for a lot of these reasons. But with the right filmmaker, someone can come along and really make magic happen. And, you know, just look at Peter Jackson and The Lord of the Rings. And I think with Denis Villeneuve, Dune has probably found that filmmaker.
I also think that, you know, if you want to say his vision, Herbert's vision in 1965, we now have the CGI and all of the technology all these years later to be able to make that some of his, even like you said, it's not like the lightsabers and all these kinds of things. The focus is not on all the tech stuff, but even just to give the massive, you know, the spice extractors or any of those kinds of things have this real heft. You couldn't do it in filmmaking almost 60 years ago, which you can now. So that I think that's on Denis' side as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little bit the situation Lucas was in with the prequel films where he knew what he wanted to do, but he didn't have the technology to do it. So he kind of had to wait for the technology to catch up with what he wanted to do. And I think that's kind of the same thing that applies here. For a long time, Dune was considered unfilmable just because you couldn't rely on CGI. And you would kind of aim to do it practically, which got very expensive very quickly. One of the things I think is really ironic, though, there's a lot of irony with this movie, but one of the things I think is very ironic is it is very CGI heavy, but it was also filmed very practically. It was shot on location with very real sets. There's a lot of CGI in the film, but absolutely not as much as there could have been. And that is what I think is unique about the director and his vision, is that he makes it feel very real, feel very lived in. It's a lot of long shots and very pretty shots of, you know, deserts and emptiness. But when you're there, it feels very real. You get the sense that you're not looking at something that was computer generated, which is so often the drawback of computer generated movies. It's one of the reasons a lot of popular films today kind of, they don't turn me off, but I sort of get drowsy when I'm watching them because I start to feel like all I'm watching is a cartoon, and there's nothing real here. You don't get that sense with Dune, but a lot of the technology needed to advance to the point where you could do that in a way that's convincing and doesn't come across as cheesy or hokey. And that's where we are. And that's what Villeneuve is doing. And I think it's really paying off.
This is a whole other conversation, but I feel like even with all the CGI and the special effects as Marvel has, all the Marvel Universe, I just think it's like, you know, you're watching a bunch of CGI. Not that I didn't think I was watching some CGI, but I felt like this universe was more lived in, more gritty, more like, oh, I could see that it could exist in 10,000 years or wherever it is set in the future. So I think he was, like you said, judicious of his use of it. This is a reminder to tell you that we are running a contest right now for a free subscription to the Christian Research Journal. We'd like for you to help us out by giving us a rating or review at Apple Podcasts. Just search for Postmodern Realities and you can put in a starred review. But in order to enter into the contest, please leave a short, brief review of our podcast about why you like to listen to it and you'll be entered in. And this will run through December 31st, 2021. And right now the odds are very good because we have very few entries. So I would like to encourage you to help us out and also be entered in to get a subscription, which if you already have a subscription, it would make a good gift for someone else or maybe even your pastor. And the other way that you can help us out is just simply tell a friend about this podcast. We just want to get the word out. An easy way to do that is to just link to your favorite episodes and share them on your social media accounts. The other way that you can help us out, if a subscription for $33.50 is not in your budget this month, would be to give us a tip. And you can easily do that. Just go to equip.org, and if you go to magazine and click the drop-down menu, you'll see Postmodern Realities Podcast. And at every single one of the landing pages, we have a link where you could give us a tip. And we'd really appreciate a tip for $3 or $5, $10, something like that. It helps us meet our budget and we pay our writers. I know a lot of stuff on the internet is free, but we think that all the research and the writing that our writers do is worth their time. And we do remunerate them for it, even though not all websites do that. We do that. And so we ask you to help us continue to bring this great content to you by subscribing or giving us a tip. But in any case, we're happy that you're joining with us. And so thank you for being a regular listener. So in your review of Dune, you talk a lot about the irony of, you know, a culture of embracing a superhero, but also embracing this property like Dune. And of course, I just ended before the break a little bit about just the Marvel CGI. This is definitely not like Marvel superheroes. Can you expound upon that a little bit? I mean, why is that an interesting dichotomy? Because I think a messiah-like figure, to me, is a little bit different than a superhero.
Yeah, you're right. They are different, but there is a very close interrelation in terms of the purpose that these individuals will serve and sort of what they spark in people. And we are in a culture that is absolutely obsessed with superheroes, for example. Marvel movies are all the rage and have been for a couple of years now. Star Wars, the poster child for modern mythology, is undergoing a renaissance. We have a lot going on in this culture. And we absolutely love heroes. And sometimes, oftentimes, we will treat those heroes as messianic figures. The narratives we love will sometimes do this themselves. I think you can make a pretty clear case that by the end of the Avengers, Iron Man has come full circle and has become a sort of messianic figure. He's literally willing to sacrifice himself and give up everything he has in this potential future to save, you know, half of everything in existence. So it's there. Those themes, those mythological themes, are come out whether we sort of anticipated them to or not. So we love heroes in this culture, and in a sense, we do worship at their altar. The irony is that Dune is, by design, the antithesis of that. It is literally meant to critique heroes and how people respond to them. So there is a very great irony here. The culture that so readily accepts figures like Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Captain America, and, yes, Iron Man, turns around and embraces Paul Atreides. And a large part of this, I think, is that we are just a movie-centric people. We don't do much interacting with narrative. We don't really do much interacting with novels, or at least as much as, you know, the world used to. And we don't really do hermeneutics. We just sort of like pretty pictures. And I don't mean to shallow out why people go to the movies. I know that not everyone does this. But when I watch reviews online after I've watched something, this is very important, actually. I avoid reviews like the plague before I see a movie, and this feeds into what I'm talking about. I actually despise Rotten Tomatoes, right? I think it's like the bane of filmmaking. A part of my soul died the moment I saw that little certified fresh sticker on the front of like a DVD case in Walmart. For whatever reason, that little percentage number has become like the permission giver for whether or not you can think a film is, you know, good. And I think that is so profoundly misguided. And in some ways, I really do think it's like borderline idiotic. I don't care if a film gets a 20% score on Rotten Tomatoes. If you can follow a narrative coherently and interact with the ideas that story contains, then a story has been told. You just might not like the way the story is told. It doesn't mean that there's some kind of objective truth behind whether you're going to enjoy it or not. For example, I've seen a lot of movies with very high critical marks that were beautiful to watch, that I thought had some pretty terrible ideas in there. And depending on how Villeneuve handles these sequels, Dune could very well be one of them. And that fascinates me. Dune is the property that really, if the cards are played right, could spell the end of the superhero culture as we know it. Because if Villeneuve and company followed Herbert closely enough, it's ultimately going to take the idea of the hero who kind of attains a messianic figure status, and it's not going to make him tragic. It's going to make him wrong. It's going to take the idea of hero worship and say it's not just a happy pastime anymore, and it's going to be exposed as flawed, if not downright nonsensical. And it's going to say a lot about what people need. It's going to say a lot about why people feel the need to run to those kinds of figures. It's going to say a lot about why people congregate around heroes and assign to them messianic status. But the cost of that, the cost of doing that, is another question. And it's that question that Herbert is interested in exploring. So I really do find it interesting that the same culture that sort of embraces one turns around and runs in the other direction as well.
So it could be that filmgoers who are introduced to the Dune universe, once they see the film, I would fall into that category, want to go ahead and read the Herbert's novels. So I'm interested in reading the novels after seeing the film. How do you think a Christian should, you know, approach these novels and interact with his ideas? And, you know, are we to be completely opposed to the ideas that he explores in the novels, especially with regard to the Messiah motif? Because a question that I had as I was watching these films was, well, two things. One is, it seemed like some of the themes in the film seemed very modern, or in other words, thinking through, and I don't know if this is true. Now, I did read a review of this, and I don't know if it's reading into it, you know, the whole idea of colonialism. I saw it briefly in the review, but I think it still would have come out to me anyway. And I don't know if he was trying to explore that when he originally wrote the books, because you have these people occupying these planets and taking their resources. And this idea of a Messiah, and it seemed to me, because you said that he borrows from, you know, just some, I would call it a vibe of Islam, is that there was this, or maybe the Crusades, there's this idea of a Messiah figure that's coming for political reasons to help us take back lands that we own, which kind of goes to the whole colonialism thing. So I don't know if that was specifically Denis Villeneuve that was doing that, or, you know, is that implicit in the books as his themes that he was trying to explore?
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. That's sort of the bait and switch that goes on here, is you're very much set up to think that what you are witnessing is almost like a colonial kind of what's often called white savior narrative. You're sort of baited into thinking, okay, this is what the story is going to be about, but then the story switches it on you and becomes a critique of that very idea. And through that narrative template, it turns what Herbert is doing, it is turn that narrative back in at you and critique the very template that it's built on and the very ideas that are cooked into it. So this is why, you know, it's almost really reductionist when you read these reviews that say, well, Dune is about a white savior narrative, or it's about critiquing a white savior narrative. Well, yes and no. It's about using that narrative template to actually begin to critique ideas, not just of white saviors, but just of saviors in general. And it's really a fascinating way to do a deconstruction of a specific type of story. And people are very confused by that. I can understand someone coming to the movie not knowing where the story is going, to see these things and go, wait a minute. But once you get through the rest of the narrative, you're gonna see, I think, very clearly that is not at all what is happening. Those tropes are being played just so that they can be flipped around and upended by story's end. As for why people sort of get lost in the maze, I think it shows a couple of things as far as the way people respond to it. I think it shows that we are a very illiterate culture, and I think it shows that we are a very confused people. Those are the two big things. We really don't know what we want or what we believe in. Do we want heroes? Sure. Do we want anti-heroes? Yeah, even more than heroes. Do we want to completely trash the idea of a hero? Why not? There is a way of looking at this and saying, look how progressive of a culture we are, that all of these ideas can float around. Well, it's not just that these ideas can float around. Anybody can say whatever they want. What interests me is the response. People are enthused with Dune. They are taking an interest in it and its ideas. And I think we were talking before this just how hard it is to get a copy out of a library right now. People are really going back and reading this book. And if you're, I mean, if you are looking at this from a 30,000 foot perspective, the same culture that just a couple of years ago gives us the Avengers is the same culture that gives us the antithesis of the idea that heroes are even good for us. And the fact that people run from one to the other, I find fascinating. If, to use a really funny illustration, if an alien art teacher or humanities teacher or literature teacher was teaching their students about 21st century American culture, their heads would spin. What are they doing? What are they getting at? What do they want? What are they trying to say? So I think we're very confused. And you can see the ideas that we are struggling with in how we bounce back and forth with these ideas. And in a lot of ways, what Dune does is put this conflict front and center. So it's interesting that Dune is, it's almost like the perfect property, the perfect science fiction property to come about right now. Is religion good for us? We don't know. We're supremely religious people. We dress up in costumes for movie premieres. You know, I'm a nerd. I've never done that. I've never gone that far, and not saying anything bad about anyone who has. That's fine. What I'm saying is recognize the drive that makes one do that. Recognize the thing that makes someone go, I love this property so much that I am literally going to put on a fictional hero's clothes and integrate myself into a community. And then many of those same people often will turn around. I have friends who do this. I want to talk around and talk about how awful the church is. And, you know, I find that, again, ironic. It's the lack of self-awareness to realize that a lot of the same emotions that you're experiencing when you put on those clothes and go to this community are a lot of the same emotions that people experience, you know, when they get up out of bed to go to church on Sunday morning. We don't know what to do with heroes in this culture. Worship them, hate them, misconstrue them. We're very confused. We're grappling with the significance of religious identity, but we don't like that term anymore. So we talk in terms of spirituality. And it's really disheartening on one level because we can't actually get to anything interesting. That's where the church really suffers. Stan Hauerwas once said something to the effect of, I wish we were a church that produced interesting atheists, but we're not strong enough believers. We are, his point being, you know, we're sort of so weak and frail in our own dispositions toward faith that when we do encounter an atheist, they're not even interesting. We're not even an interesting challenge for them. We're that boring. And I wholeheartedly agree with the man. Christians in this culture are by and large so superficial in their interest for matters of faith that we are actually very boring. And, you know, a good example is how people will respond to Dune. We'll run from this and not deal with it and not interact with Herbert and not interact with Villeneuve and will not have conversations about it. And there's just nothing interesting about Christians in 21st century America. We let the culture dictate the terms on which we fight our battles. And then we show up late and like to act surprised when we lose the proverbial culture wars, which I think is just a terrible way of looking at culture and society to begin with. I'm not interested in winning the culture wars. We've lost. This is an announcement. We've lost, folks. What I'm interested in is taking casualties well, which sounds cynical, but I do believe in a resurrection. And I just think we get sidetracked from that truth and lost in the fray. So I think we should be interacting with stories like Dune. And I think Frank Herbert's original novel is interested in interacting with people like us. The people who are going to have the most interesting response to what he wrote are people like Christians. And the film represents an opportunity to do that. And I think we should take it. Now, I know that's sort of a long-winded answer to interacting with the film. As far as Herbert's ideas and the novels, should we be completely opposed to the ideas that he explores? No, I don't think we should be opposed to it because, in a way, the Old Testament is full of these kinds of stories. You meet all of these potential messiahs, Noah, David, and all of them fall. All of them fail. They are the posts along the road leading to Jesus of Nazareth. So, first of all, the notion of a heroic messianic type figure failing miserably is something we should not be surprised by. It's literally most of the Bible. But of course, that leads us to Christ, which is where everyone is going to take the meat of this discussion. And Herbert has an interesting perspective on this. He says, okay, even if you have an infallible hero, it's the fallible people who take up the hero's cause that ultimately cause the problems. And that, in our context, would be the church. And anybody who's read the New Testament beyond the Gospels will know that almost as soon as the church started, there were issues. The Judaizers began teaching the Gentiles that they had to be circumcised to follow the law before they were considered real Christians. And the rest of the New Testament is written, the epistles are written to people in the churches for the purpose of encouraging them. And, you know, not to turn this into a theological discussion, but if people like Paul didn't believe that it was possible for a Christian to go awry, for a believer in the church to crash and burn, the rest of the New Testament would not have been written. There's literally no need for it. Look at Paul's letters to Timothy, for example. They are the most moving human things you'll ever read. Paul tells Timothy, look, everybody has left me. All the Christians in Asia Minor left me. Don't you leave me too. Rekindle the gift that I know you have. Rekindle the spark. Don't go astray. Stay on the path as I have. Fight the good fight. Finish the race. Keep the faith. If he didn't think it was possible for Timothy to not do that, there is zero reason to write it. So the people who take up the Savior's cause are fallible. And we shouldn't be afraid of critique. We need to keep our finger on the pulse of how we're viewed by the world. If Christ's disciples, his closest friends, were known to the world by their love for one another, and we today, who believe we carry on that legacy, are known as the troublemakers of the world, I'm not saying that's a totally accurate assessment, but I'm also not saying it's totally inaccurate either. And we shouldn't be afraid of that because we believe what we believe. We believe Christianity makes all of these lofty assertions about reality and the way the world is and the way the world will be, and we believe that. And in light of that, I think we can and should look at somebody like Frank Herbert and say, you know, hey man, I hear you, I see what you're saying, and it's interesting. We may have failed in some respects, and you have an interesting take on it. We often mar the legacy of Christ that we claim to carry on. That's a fair critique. But what's the alternative? See, Herbert was, as far as I know, he was a Zen Buddhist. That's what's often said, though I am not aware of any good primary source that shows that. I hear it a lot. I have never seen anything that says definitively this is what the guy was. But just because he uses these Eastern ideas doesn't make him a Buddhist. Herbert himself wouldn't say that we can just get away from myth. He literally uses it as a template for his story. He understands that people can't get away from this stuff. Religion, mythic figures, messiahs, heroes. People can't get away from it. It's always going to be around. The point of his story is to show you that there are reasons behind why people flock to those figures. He is interested in why people go looking for saviors. I'm interested in that too. There's a big hole shot right through the heart of the world by sin, and I'm interested in that. And if you don't understand that, you don't understand the gospel, and you certainly don't understand why a man had to die for you. And if that's what Dune wants to get around to discussing, then I think we absolutely should not be afraid of that.
Well, I think the other thing that it does, I mean, beyond the obvious undertones in the film and obviously the book with regard to is Paul this particular messiah of this religious order, is that religion does play a part in this universe, in that there are religious sects, the biggest one out there being this, I think, Bene Gesserit sect that his mother belongs to. And of course, as is shown a couple of times in the movie, they have specific powers that they use and employ, and he's been trained in these powers. Paul has, the main character. And so is the religion of Dune, as you know, it unfolds both in the movies and the books, is it really more like pre-Reformation Christianity, where you have Roman Catholicism that was, you know, kind of also theocracy? In other words, they were controlling politics, they were controlling the church. And it seems that this particular sect that's very powerful, that his mother belongs to, also controls some of the politics and is very close to the emperor of this universe. You don't see the emperor in this film, but you know there's one out there. So does the fact that there is this specific religion, and then of course, but when they get to the planet Arrakis, the main, I don't know what she is she a witch or a sorceress or something like that, that comes to visit, who trained his mother, comes to visit them on their home, Caladan World Planet. She kind of says, well, we've seeded the people, the Fremen, to think that Paul coming is that. So is he kind of exploring true supernatural, miraculous things through this religion, or more like superstition? We can move politics by, as they say in the film, playing the long game.
Yeah, that's one of the things that he does very interestingly, is he does show that the tether between politics and religion. And I do think it is religion, the way he sort of articulates this. One of the reasons, and I do want to touch on this, it just came to me as you were asking about it. One of the reasons you find a lot of religious fiction, religious orders in fiction, sort of skewed almost as like Catholic. I think as Protestants, we really forget that the face of Christianity to the world is Catholicism, by and large. The figure that's going to represent Christianity to the world is the Pope. So if the question is ever, should we pray for the Pope? Yes, please do. He's literally representing you whether you like it or not. And that's not to say we're Roman Catholics. That's just how the world sees us. It is the largest branch. It is the largest sect. So when you see a lot of fiction try to begin to personify religious orders and things like that, or design these religious motifs, it's going to start to look a lot like Catholicism. And you know, Herbert's a product of his time, but he's also an American, so he understands that there are different sects and groups within Christianity, especially. Although I think more so than Christianity, I don't think he's so much interested in dealing with the Christian faith. I think he's a little more drawn to Islam because the idea of messiahs and this continual chain of messiahs is cooked into Islam a little more than, far more than Christianity. We have one messiah. And Islam, especially with the modest movements, there's this constant like cropping up of messianic figures, and you know, T. Lawrence is sort of the classic, you know, what you might call white savior narrative, even though that's really not quite what it is. It's really a great story and a very classic movie. But those ideas are what he's interested in doing. As far as the Bene Gesserits, you do get a very good a feel for the tethering of politics and religion there. The way they sort of, like you say, play the long game. They use the religion to influence politics. And there is some superstition that's wrapped in there. It really isn't clear. Watching the film, what they are. It's very mystical in that sense. It almost feels like, you know, throwback original trilogy Star Wars. You're kind of like, what are Jedi and what is the Force? It's kind of how you feel with these people. It's like, what can they do? What powers do they have? They're clearly not normal. So yeah, I think those ideas are there and they intersect in interesting ways. And I'm very interested to see what people begin to do with that as the sequels come out, which I think one is scheduled for 2023, I think is the next one. So it's definitely an interesting time to be getting into Dune.
So for those getting into Dune, like myself, are there any resources that you can recommend to our listeners to help them understand Frank Herbert and his work better? And specifically, like you're just touching on things that he was weaving in there, but it seems that like there's a little bit more philosophy or thought, maybe perhaps because it started out in a written form than say Star Wars, where it's kind of like, you know, George Lucas had these ideas and then they've since been developed after his original idea.
Yes, there is a wonderful biography of the man by Timothy O'Reilly. It is simply called Frank Herbert. I believe that book is out of print now. It was released in 1981, but the book is available to read in its entirety online at O'Reilly.com. And I encourage anyone interested in Dune, interested in Herbert, interested in where he got his ideas, interested in how he wrote it, and it's to see what influenced him, read that book. Actually, as I was preparing for this interview and this podcast, I went back and revisited. There was a link to a whole chapter, and there I have a friend who's really, really into Dune. He loves the books. He loved the movie, and I copied the chapter, and I sent it to him, and I said, read this chapter and then read the book. You'll really like it, and he did. So again, it's called Frank Herbert by Timothy O'Reilly. If you just search for it on Google, you'll find it. If you're fortunate enough to find a copy of the book, hang on to it. It's probably worth something.
Yeah, I just went on Amazon, and I guess used copies selling for over $1,000. He should self-publish that again or something, get it back out there. Well, this is very interesting, and listeners can stay tuned because it looks like in 2 years, October 2023, part two will be out. So that's a lot of reading of Dune and Dune sequels and prequels and all those kinds of other things if people want to get into them. Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I have a couple of rapid fire questions for Cole to help our listeners get to know our authors better. So it's November. What's your favorite Thanksgiving dinner side dish?
Side dish? Oh, goodness. I would probably say mashed potatoes. Does that count as a side dish?
It sure does.
It's about to.
I know I've asked you this before, but I haven't given you all the choices in the sci-fi universes. So if you had to live in one, would it be Star Wars universe, Star Trek, or Dune?
Well, not Dune, I can tell you that. Real quick. Yeah, I can rule out that third option real quick. I don't know. Star Wars seems okay, so I can get really deep nerd for a second. Star Wars seems fun until you realize that everybody who lives in that is miserable, right? Star Trek is going to be infinitely more fun. So if I had to live in one, I'd probably say Star Trek. Even though Star Wars has the Force and it's cool, I'd probably be some guy that, you know, got shot by a Mandalorian just trying to work on a farm. So Star Trek.
Yeah, Star Wars, I don't know. Star Wars seems like there's some camp to it and it's interesting. But Star Trek, I guess, because if you think about why it was created to have this utopia where we believe the best in people, maybe that would end up being better in the long run.
Yeah, exactly. In Star Wars, you have empires that rise and fall every 20, 30 years. Like, people have severe whiplash as to what's going to happen.
Yes, I don't know. There is the empire, but there's the pre-empire, and it's very confusing and also stuff that was never explained.
I think the funniest part of The Rise of Skywalker to me is when they all show up at the end. It's like nobody comes to help Leia at the end of The Last Jedi, but the second they hear Palpatine's return, the entire galaxy shows up and is like, we're done. We're not doing this again. It was enough the first time. We're over it. So Star Trek it is.
Yeah, the Star Wars, and it gets a little primitive. So I don't know. The whole Westerns in The Mandalorian, it's just very also kind of, you know, unless you shoot people, you're going to die.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, thanks, Cole, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
You've been listening to episode 261 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. This has been a conversation with guest Cole Burgett about the film Dune, directed by Denis Villeneuve. All of our subscribers to the Christian Research Journal can read his online exclusive film review at our website, equip.org, for free. If you're not already a subscriber, please go to our website, equip.org, to subscribe.